And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Ole Damegaard about the JFK assassination and the Death Squad Network. And we've been running through basically many, many of the names, many of the, you know, the people that you basically can go and read more about and, again, discover just how well connected they are into the greater criminal, the organized criminal network. It's just extraordinary to just, you know, run through some of these names quickly and kind of see what they've actually been involved in as well. But why don't we just pick up the story, Ole? I mean, there's much more to it, but basically where we left off, you're talking about all the boys network basically coming together, having a reunion of sorts back in Dallas. So let's just continue from there.
I think one of the reasons why this assassination is very interesting and important to understand how it was carried out and to study it in great detail is that it's actually been used ever since as a training example for CIA operatives and for military snipers and so on of how to carry out a political assassination on a high level. So it's been used as the template. And this is also why, I think it's extremely important to expose what was going on there so that we can see what's going on nowadays. Because, once again, it's the same power elite behind this one that are still in power. All these white-haired guys in the White House and other places, they didn't just pop up out of the ground. They have a long life before them, and they have spent many, many years proving their loyalty to the cause by doing not very clean things, many of them, very ugly stuff going around.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So if we go back to Lee Bowers, Lee Bowers was a man that was working in this, like a little tower, watchtower, on the parking lot behind or to the side of the school book depository. And what he saw was he had a clear view down towards the picket fence and down towards the street where the motorcade was about to appear. Like I said, he saw three different cars coming in from 20 minutes before the assassination up until the assassination itself. The first was a black Ford Falcon, and we identified the man driving it as Aldo Vera Serafin, a highly, highly skilled, very highly paid assassin. I think I said his name, Aldo Vera Serafin.
Was that actually his name, Serafin?
Yeah, that's his name.
Interesting.
He was later brutally murdered as well.
Because that means, I just kind of rich symbolic note there, but that basically means a branch of the archangels, one of the thirds that fell from the heavens, and they actually, some of the angels in that classification was like Beelzebub and Lucifer and everything else, and it's a Swedish order that's given to foreign people, I believe, by the king of Sweden today. That's called the Order of the Seraphim. So that's just an interesting note, actually.
Yeah, even the Lisbeth Palmer was given that, as far as I know.
Oh, really? That was probably when they still gave it to people within Sweden. I know at some point they started shifting over, just giving it to foreign people for some reason. But that's interesting, right?
Yeah, really. And you can ask why she was given it by all people.
Well, exactly. Of course.
So first there was this black Ford Falcon that was driving around. And the reason I would say that they were driving around, they were just keeping all the different people, checking everything was under control, checking that everybody was in position, and giving back order or reports over the radio to wherever this center of control was. My personal theory is that was at the Adolphus Hotel. And if you look at, let me just go back to the second car that Lee Bowers observed. He said it was a 1959 Oldsmobile, and that it had a Barry Goldwater sticker on the back. It was had out-of-state license plates, and it was a bit dirty. When you check out the car that Chauncey Hall, Charles Nicoletti, and the other guys came from Arizona, that was a 1959 Oldsmobile. It had a Barry Goldwater sticker. It had out-of-state license plates from Arizona. And it was dirty because of the heavy rain. So I would say the chances that that was the car is very big.
Right.
And I would guess that it was the guy that drove them was either the pilot Joe Canty or the other guy, Leo Mosseri, the mob guy. Joe Canty was later the pilot that flew out Chucky Nicoletti, no, Charles Nicoletti, out of. Sorry, I'm mixing them up. Doesn't matter. Forget
Okay.
about that.
All right.
Anyway, so that was car number two. And then the last car he saw was a Chevy Impala 61 or 62, I think. Out of state plates, entered some 7 minutes before the shot. It was dirty as well, four doors, possibly a station car. Now, if you look at Dealey Plaza, maybe I should describe Dealey Plaza a little bit. If you look at, if you take Main Street that comes from downtown Dallas, where the motorcade came from, if you take that in a straight line and it going towards the trademark where he was going to hold the speech, there's a street called Houston Street, and that is almost like the bottom of a pyramid. Many of these assassinations are carried out with symbolic ritual meanings that I'm not so knowledgeable about, but very often there are this structure of streets going in a pyramid shape, or the obelisk in the nearby neighborhood, or the eternal flame on or this is a place that used to be a gravesite, or where they chopped the head of people, or something like that. When you look at Dealey Plaza, you have exactly that pyramid shape of the streets, and you got an obelisk there as well. So I don't know if that's a coincidence. I'm just pointing it out. Anyway, so you got Houston Street as the bottom of the Main Street going straight up through the pyramid. Then you got Houston Street going as the bottom of the pyramid. And then that one makes a left turn, very, very heavy left turn, 120 degrees, into Elm Street that then continues and passes by the School Book Depository and the grassy knoll. And then they meet where the Triple Underpass is. Then, like, there are three different streets going, but that's sort of the top of the pyramid. So the motorcade was supposed to go straight forward, but what happened was instead it came, when it came to Houston Street, it made a 90 degree turn to the right and then a 120 degree to the left. And the buildings around here were you had the local jail, then you had another building, then on the corner there's a building called the Daltex building, where on the second floor there was a CIA front cover company on the second floor, and then you had the School Book Depository on the corner between Houston and Elm Street. After the school, Texas School Book Depository, there's a big open space, and then it comes up to where the so-called grassy knoll is, where behind that is the picket fence where one of the shooters was positioned, and behind that a big open parking area with some rail tracks in the background. And then, like I said, all these three streets goes in under what is called the Triple Underpass. It's a very strange layout of a place when you look at it. There's small sculptures and white walls, and so it's not easy to describe if you don't know what it looks like, but it also makes a perfect place for different shooters to position themselves. So as far as I've been able to figure out, I'm just going to reverse a little bit. James Files, who was the driver for Chucky Nicoletti, he was and who was driving around some days before the hit team together with Lee Oswald. He was given the task in the morning to come to the Cabana Motor Hotel. And at the Cabana Motor Hotel, Chucky Nicoletti was staying. He was there given the order to drive Johnny Rosselli, who was also staying there, drive him to Fort Worth, where he was going to meet up with someone that was going to give him an envelope with some stuff. When James Files picked up Johnny Rosselli, he noticed another guy that he knew, a mobster from LA called Hale Brading. Hale Brading, we're going to come back to later on. He drove Johnny Rosselli to a pancake house just in the outskirts of Fort Worth. And there, Rosselli asked him to sit in the background and just cover him if something bad should go down. So he parked outside and then came into the restaurant, and James Files positioned himself so that he could easily shoot whoever if there was any type of problems. The man that came in and sat down together with Johnny Rosselli was Jack Ruby. And Jack Ruby had with him an envelope that it later turned out was it was a handwritten map of Dealey Plaza, where the route had, the change of the route was filled in, and also some of these Secret Service IDs that were being used as well. So they drove back, and when they came to the Cabana Moto Hotel, he waited for Chucky Nicoletti to come down. So Johnny Rosselli left the car and Nicoletti came back. After that, they drove down to Dealey Plaza, and about an hour before the assassination, like I mentioned before, there was this second plan going on about aborting the whole operation. It seems like one part of the CIA had found out that this hit on JFK was going down, and they wanted to stop it in any way possible. So they had given the orders, abort the operation, abort, abort. But Chucky Nicoletti, when he was told that, he said, no way, the only one that can call this off is Sam Giancana. And he says, go, go, go. So Chucky Nicoletti said, we're doing it anyway. Johnny Rosselli, though, who was the connection with the CIA and the mob, got a bit cold feet. So he said, I don't want to be part of this. I can't do the shooting. At that point, Chucky Nicoletti made contact with James Files and said, how would you feel about backing me up on this one? And Files, who said that Chucky Nicoletti was one of the men he admired most in life, he said this Nicoletti guy, he could walk on water. I mean, he really treated him like, he speaks about him so highly, I tell you. He always calls him Mr. Nicoletti, never anything else than that. He said, I would be honored to do this. And he had James Files, for him, it was just another hit. He didn't care. And also, he had a lot of friends who died in the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the whole surroundings that he was living in hated JFK. So he was fine with shooting me. He didn't care at all.
Right.
So he positioned himself behind the picket fence, and Chucky Nicoletti went into the Daltex building. Now, Rosselli and Nicoletti, they needed somebody to let them in into the Daltex building. So what they did was they had Files park the Chevy Impala outside the Daltex, on the back of the Daltex building, and he reversed it so that they could easily just slip into the car, put the weapons in the trunk, and so on. So that car was parked by the Daltex building. And then this Hale Brading, the Chicago mobster from LA, he was the guy who opened the back door and let them in. So Rosselli and Nicoletti went in that way, and in there they were met by a man called Nestor Izquierdo, a black mercenary guy who was very closely connected to Operation 40. He was the spotter in there. And then, as far as I and some other researchers have been able to figure out, also George Bush Sr. was present in that building, in that room when the shots were fired. So there were four people there. And when you see, often these teams have one spotter, one shooter, and sometimes one breakdown guy, what they call, and this person's, his task is to take apart the weapons and transport them away from the site, away from the shooter. The shooter should only focus on shooting and hitting. That's the main thing. The spotter, his job is to check that everything is okay, that there's no trouble coming in, that also that there's an escape route, that so he has to keep the clearance. And if there's a breakdown guy, he will also take care of any shells or anything like that. So some of these team had a breakdown guy, others, they only had a spotter. So that was the Daltex building. Then when we moved into the Texas School Book Depository, in the so-called sniper's nest on the sixth floor of this Texas School Book Depository, which, by the way, was owned by a colonel who was an oil tycoon, but he was also the founder of the Louisiana Civil Air Patrol. I don't know if you know that.
No.
This Civil Air Patrol was a place where they recruited young guys. One of the people that was in charge of this was a man by the name of Dave Ferry, who was also very central in the JFK assassination. And he's the guy in the JFK movie with the strange eyebrows and the wig because he had cancer and so on. Very strange character.
Right.
But also in that this Civil Air Patrol, there were other people like Barry Seals, who later was part of Operation 40 as a CIA operative pilot, and who was very extremely central in the Iran-Contras scandal. One of the pilots flying in and out, all of these things. Another of the pilots was this man I mentioned before, Tosh Plumlee, who was part of the abort operation. This I'm just going to mention that this Barry Seals as well, he was just about to give testimony against George Bush Senior when he was gunned down in Baton Rouge in Louisiana just 1 week before the killing of Olof Palme. And Olof Palme was also involved in these international gun affairs with links going into P2 and with George Bush Senior and these guys. So
Yeah.
if that's a coincidence or not, but the timing, they started cleaning out with Barry Seals and it just kept going. You have Uwe Barschel in West Germany and lots of different suicides there. And also in the States, there was a lot of cleaning going on there.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, and another man that we're going to come back to in this Civil Air Patrol was a man called Walter Tobinski, also called Wally. This is a very unknown man in these circles, but he and his accomplice Clyde Forshaw and a third one called Roland Otis. These three are also very central in this conspiracy, and they have been super central in many of the major conspiracies that has been taken off, and also been part of a cleanup team that has cleaned up, I would say, around 1,000 people. At least that is what some very reliable witness has been informing about.
Right.
But this Walter Tobinski, he was also in this Civil Air Patrol. But if we go back to this Texas School Book Depository, in the so-called sniper's nest, as far as I've been able to find out, the man that was sitting in that window, his name was Eladio Del Valle. He was a former agent for the Batista regime on Cuba. He was part of Operation 40, and he was also a very skilled shooter and so on. The man next to him was a spotter, a black man by the name of Herminio Diaz Garcia, also part of Operation 40, highly skilled assassin. He did several hits on different dictators or presidents in Central America and so on, and was later shot down and killed in Mexico City. Then in the window on the same floor, this floor is one big room, and in the window furthest to the west, if you say that, was the people, the witnesses observed a white male with very heavy rim, what do you call it, rim-horned glasses, you know, like very like that. That was the shooter from that window. Now, after the shots had been fired, what happened was that there was a witness on the other side of Dealey Plaza that saw four people run out on the backside of the school book depository, and they jumped into a car that looked like a Rambler, a Nash Rambler, and then took off north, going up away from Dealey Plaza that way. Now, when you look at it, one thing this day was that the elevator was not working in the school book depository. And there's a big mystery how, if Lee Harvey Oswald had been the shooter, how did he manage to get down on the second floor where he was observed by other people working there, but also confronted by one of the first police that ran into the school, Texas School Book Depository. He was standing in the lunchroom, just drinking a Coca-Cola, being totally calm, not out of breath and something. So it's a major mystery if he was the shooter, how on earth did he manage to get down there in just a few minutes? At the same time, there was also some female workers that was that were using the staircases. So and they didn't see anyone come down that road. So how did he get down there? I mean, the obvious answer is he did not.
Right.
But how did the shooters get away? How did they get from the sixth floor and down and go come out on the back of this building? My theory is that these people, like I said, they were highly skilled assassins, trained in jungle warfare, climbing, all of these type of things. And I believe that Lee Harvey Oswald's task was to block the elevator, because when you if you look the drawings of the school book depository, exactly where the lunchroom is and where he was standing, that is exactly where the elevators, the shaft are going down. So I believe that his task was to stand there and make sure that nobody used the elevator going up that would disturb the whole thing. And that the people, the three shooters up there, what they did was that they took ropes and they just went down with ropes inside the elevator shafts and then were let out on the backside of the building, running out that way. The when you look at the what these people looked like, one of the people that was driving this Nash Rambler, it was parked on the wrong side of Houston Street, right on the corner of the school book depository. And the description of this guy matches perfectly David Morales, that I mentioned before, the killer of Che Guevara, and who was also involved in the assassination of Robert Kennedy and so on. Also, when you see some of the photos of Dealey Plaza, if you enlarged a major big time, you will see that somebody that looks a lot like David Morales was hanging around one of these light pole posts right on the corner of where the car was parked. So I would say that David Morales was the driver. He's the driver who's later seen by Sheriff Roger Craig, where he saw that this Nash Rambler was coming like some minutes after the shootings, and that somebody was whistling, and he stopped and picked up this guy. Roger Craig identified this man that he picked up as Lee Harvey Oswald. And Roger Craig tried to stop the car because it was driving off, but there was too much traffic and he couldn't stop them. But he thought they were very suspicious. And he described them, the way he described the driver was very much like you would describe David Morales from
Right.
Operation 40.
Right.
But the people that came out, three of them went into the car and took off north on Houston Street. The fourth started running along Houston Street, and then that's the bottom of the pyramid. And then he came to the left corner of the pyramid, if we say it like that, and then turned left onto a street called Commerce Street. And just a few hundred meters down that street is where the Adolphus Hotel is, and that is where Richard Caine, the hitman of Sam Giancana, was staying together with Sam Giancana. And if once again, if you look at the description of that shooter, the glasses, all of that, it fits perfectly on Richard Caine. This was also exposed in a book called The Double Cross, by one of the relatives, the brother and nephew of Sam Giancana. So these were the people. The other two that I identified on this floor has been named by the Cuban Secret Service. So I'm not saying just throwing out names lightly. These are, I believe that they're very, very likely to be the correct names.
Right.
Okay, so we continue, and then when we go down on street level, there's this so-called umbrella man, a man that with a black umbrella that was standing, even though it was sunny, he was just standing there with a black umbrella when the motorcade came.
Yep.
And there's a lot of theories saying that he had a dart gun or a poison thing or a secret weapon within the umbrella. I would say his task was to show the cross point for the different teams, saying that this is the point where you start shooting, because you can't have like 20 different shots going off at this in a long row. That would just be impossible to blame it on one lone patsy. So everybody had to shoot at the same time. And also, I think that more than one shooter was using silencers, because also to avoid the confusion with sound and so on.
Right.
So he was stand there, and his name was, as far as I know, Roy Hargraves. He was also very closely connected to Operation 40, Soldier of Fortune guy. In front of him, there's a Cuban guy, or he looks Cuban, and he's waving. And sometimes he's referred to as to the waving guy. This man, as far as I've been able to identify, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago. And he later, in his career working for the CIA, became a man that recruited assassins on a global scale. He was in Africa, he was in South America, and so on. And he was in Stockholm in the fall of 1985, some months before the assassination of Olof Palme, trying to recruit shooters in Sweden. He used the alias Charles Morgan, and he was working for a CIA front company called ITT. And so here you are again, connections, connections, connections.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side of the street, this is just around the corner. We've just passed the Texas School Book Depository. When you look at the Zapruder film, there's a road sign called the Stemmons Freeway road sign. And when you look at the Zapruder film, it's very obvious after a while that it's been manipulated. It jumps, and it looks like the frame's missing, and the background is not, it changes, and it's been manipulated. Now, the reason, or the big question is, why was it manipulated? What did they try to cover up? And like I say, this was a film that was filmed by a man, a bystander by the name of Zapruder, Abraham Zapruder. He was a dressmaker working in the same building as he was working in the Daltex building from where some of the shots were fired. It's also said that he was that Lyndon Johnson was somebody who helped him into the country, that there were direct connections
Right.
between Lyndon Johnson. And this can be a coincidence, but when you look at the Zapruder film in the background, look not just at the limo, you have to check out all the surroundings around. You will see that there, it looks like there's four different people within a square, like maybe 100 meters on both sides of the street, where there are two people filming that has never been identified, on just opposite the grassy knoll, but also on the Zapruder side. The four in total, and these people have never been identified. But when you speak to military personnel in the States and so on, they say that they were instructed by the CIA with films showing the assassination, showing this as a test, a perfect example how an assassination is supposed to be carried out. So who were these people filming?
Yeah.
You know, you really had to look, because normal people were standing along Main Street, because that was where the newspaper said that the caravan, the motorcade would pass. But then this strange turning is very crucial. So who were the people standing there, and why were they there? And you will see that, I mean, like this Santiago that I just mentioned, Charles Morgan. You will see that he sits down next to the man with the umbrella just after the shots. And then when he stands up, you can see that he's got a walkie-talkie in his back pocket. There's another guy on the other side of the street with another walkie-talkie. His name was Jim Hicks. He was a radio operator. He admitted he was part of it. And so on. But right in front of the umbrella man, on the other side, and just where the Zapruder film starts jumping, when the limo passes behind the Stemmons Freeway sign, that is exactly where the first shot hit JFK, and it hit him right in the throat. Now, most researchers believe that this shot was fired straight from the front. I've always thought that as well. But about a year ago, I got in touch through Professor Jim Fetzer, who's one of the world's leading experts on this assassination. I got in touch with a witness, a woman called Haley Otis, a very, very brave woman, who claimed to have grown up together with some people that had turned into be the worst serial killers ever in modern history, as far as I know, and people who were directly involved in the JFK assassination, in Robert Kennedy, the assassination of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the blowing up of John Jr., Kennedy's plane as well. And also they were major parts in the cleaning up when it came to taking care of witnesses and other people that they wanted to get rid of over the years. I mean, we're talking about 1,000 people at least that these people have killed.
Yeah.
Now, on the other side, like I said, just opposite the Umbrella Man, there's a person there with a bulletproof vest, believe it or not, a big bulletproof vest. He's dressed in light clothes and a big bulletproof vest. And you can see on the Zapruder film, if you see it, he's just when the film starts jumping, he's aiming, he's got almost like a tactical stand, and he's aiming a small weapon towards JFK at the same time as he grabs to his throat. Because JFK is turned towards him just when the shots are fired. That's when the film goes strange and so on. But you will see him tactical stand, and it looks exactly like he's shooting, and then he just let his hands drop down by his side. Behind him is a man in a gray suit, which I believe was this Orlando Bosch, also from Operation 40, called Dr. Death. I believe he's the guy standing behind him. Now this, Walter Tobinski is his name.
Yeah, that's right.
And Walter Tobinski was part of the Civil Air Patrol as well. He was brought up and trained from a very early age as a killer. They started with animals, and then they went. They were trained to kill children, and then from children up to women, and then up, up, up. And so these, I must say, poor people have been totally brainwashed and emotionally damaged from a very, very young age into becoming perfect killing machines. Now, this man, Walter Tobinski, has been identified by this woman, Haley Otis, who knew all of these three people and who said that they have also told her and described these different assassinations in big detail. So she was the one telling me about this the first time, or telling Jim Fetzer, and I just couldn't believe it when she said that he was there, and he said that he shot JFK with a tranquilizer right in the throat, and the reason for that was to make him not be able to move so that the other people could finish the job. It sounded really crazy to start with, but when you start studying the Zapruder film, start watching exactly when it disappears behind the freeway, the Stemmons freeway sign, you will see him up in the right corner. Like I said, big bulletproof vest. You can see there's other photos later taken of him, like a minute later, when he just slowly walks towards the school book depository. Very calm, very relaxed, doesn't seem to have a worry in the world. But a massive big bulletproof vest. I mean, it's so obvious when you see it. And when you hear the doctors at Parkland, when they described the bullet wound, they said that he had been hit just underneath the Adam's apple, and that there was a very small hole of entry. It was like 3 to 4 millimeters. And if you look at it from listening to Haley Otis, this is exactly what goes down. JFK moves towards the left, and he's hit right in the throat by this guy. We're talking about a distance like 3 meters, 2-3 meters. So it's a turkey shoot, very easy. And the car is so moving so slow, so it's super easy to do. Anyway, On then we continued down the road. That was the first shot. Then at that point, there were shots starting being fired from all different directions, even though you could only hear some of them. In the preparation as well, when the motorcade passed Adolfo's hotel and a little bit further down, one of the motorbike police officers blocked the radio channel so that it couldn't be used during the assassination. By mistake, it said, I would say not. But that is at the same time recorded the whole event, but where you could hear the very faint, but you could still hear the shots being fired. And that together with the Zapruder film is what being used as proof showing that there was a conspiracy going on. But at least the Zapruder film has been very manipulated, so you can't really trust that either. But once again, why was it manipulated? And I would say one of the major reasons is that the limo came to a total standstill. Once the shot started coming, instead of just speeding up, for some reason, the driver, Bill Greer, just stepped on the brake and the car came to more or less a full stop. And then boom came the final headshot. You can see the driver looks over his shoulder. Once he sees boom, he's done. Then he takes off big time. So how they control him, if he was mind controlled or whatever, I do not understand, because I mean they were really in the line of fire, these people. But
And so many is an incredible amount of people there as well, and all these weird, kind of mix between diversions and just, strange behavior, as you said, between the umbrella and the waving guy, and it's like, they're all there in that one spot. It's just amazing. There was one movie, I forget what the name was now. I saw it a while back. It was a little bit of, allegedly. Well, I mean, we know what we should how we should filter movies, of course. So. I'm not saying that this is the truth or anything like that, but they tried it at least to show a little bit on the background, and they could just be interesting even for the purposes of propaganda, of seeing, all right, what angle do they want us to see or know in terms of Zapruder and how he took the film and everything else. I'll find the name of the movie. It was, I think it was last year or the year before that it was released. It was pretty interesting, but it shows a little bit of that dilemma. He didn't want to release it first. He didn't want to have it on his, shoulders. He was afraid of what's going to happen to him and everything else. But I know of plenty of people who've said that that Zapruder was part of it as well. He was in the usual questions like, okay, why was it there and filming and the way he did it, the location and everything else. So there's a lot of opinions flying around about that and about that guy, of course.
I mean, when you look at it, like I said, it looks like there's four or five professional photographers there, with him included, in this very tiny little spot. And his film is the only one that is known. But also, the reason why it was known was that it was taken and they took it to, they went straight to the TV studios with it, I think, instead of the other ones was whatever happened to them, confiscated. Or I really truly believe that these people, when you look at them, the other photographers, they've all got suits and ties, and they look very much like federal agents. Like I say, they went straight to the film studio, the TV studio, just minutes after, and he was interviewed, and that was why they couldn't suppress this one. But what happened was that I think it was the day after, one of the owners of Time magazine, I think it was, went there and offered him $15,000 for it, and he just sold it. And from then, they just took this film and put it into a safe, and it was there for years and years and years, until I think it was Robert Grodin, a researcher, managed to get a copy of it. And he was the one who started in his own time finding out, my God, what is this film showing? Because nobody knew about it. And so he was very scared for his own safety until this was revealed. And anyway,
That movie, by the way,
so
is called Parkland. It's from 2013, and it's Paul Giamatti in the role of that, and it shows some of the interesting things and hopefully some of the things in there are accurate in terms of what actually happened. But again, very doubtful that that is the case. But it could be something for people to shake up as well. Yeah.
yeah, it's in this area, it's really hard to know what is true and what isn't,
Sure.
because it's so manipulated. And just like you say, when it comes out like a film, Well, I would take it very easy before
Well,
you start
definitely. Exactly.
trusting
I would
anything.
say almost it's the opposite. It's you want to
Yeah.
see, you want to know where they're trying to take your attention, so that you want to look in the opposite direction, or maybe not opposite, but away from that to a certain degree. But how do you go about? I mean, I've asked you this before, Ulla, but how do you go about filtering some of the information, and in terms of what sources you dive into, considering that there's just so much of it at this stage?
It's very hard. It's very hard to know, and I try to double check and triple check from different, but also to see how the pieces fits together, and also to really check out who is delivering, who what is the track record, with lies and any chance of them being paid off or doing it for some reason. And so it's not easy, but like I said, this is 30 years down the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyway, if we continue, this one is, like I say, absolutely incredible, Walter Tobinski, because he lives in Toronto today, if he's still alive, and he's been very active over many years, taking out many of these witnesses together with his accomplice Clyde Forshaw and Haley Otis' brother. His name was Roland Otis. I think he's dead now. But as far as I've been able to figure out with the testimonies of Haley Otis, I just want to say that it seems very unfortunate, but it seems like she's been murdered now recently. That
There is
just
a,
so.
by the way, just to give you a quick note on that, there is a Walter Tobinski, who died in 1989. There's a record of that if you just Google the name, and it comes out of Saskatchewan in Canada, by the way. It's from a website called findagrave.com, of all places. So.
Yeah, I will also say that many of these people, like for instance, Jose Perdomo, who was also a member of Operation 40, he officially died in 1974, and then he was the doorman when John Lennon was shot down. He was standing exactly in the position where the shots were fired from, and he was one of the highest ranking officers in Operation 40 for almost 10 years. So you can very easily die first, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yep,
On
of course,
paper,
of course.
because this is the perfect way you die, and then you're used to under they got multiple identities. And if you, for instance, James Fires that we've been talking about here, officially he died at birth. He didn't he was born in 1942 and he died at birth.
Right,
That's
yep.
the papers. Anyway, on the other side of the on the side of the grassy knoll, you have where Zapruder was standing. He was standing up on like a concrete thing. And then next to him, there's a bush. And next to him, there's a strange white wall that comes out in an angle. And then a few meters behind that is the picket fence. So it's a little tricky to describe what it looks like. There's also a staircase going up over the grassy knoll. And it comes up between this wall, this white wall, and the picket fence. So behind that, this is exactly where the final shots were fired. And there's a figure there at the corner of this wall, behind the wall, somebody that they've named as Black Dog or Badge Man. Now, there's a lot of theories that says that this could not have been somebody standing there because it's all out of proportions. The thing is that this wall it goes up to the waist more or less, and the shooter, which I truly believe was this French assassin called Lucien Sarti, he was kneeling behind the wall and firing. He was dressed in a Dallas police uniform. You can see they managed to enlarge a photo where you can clearly see that there's a man in a police uniform. Without a hat on, his dark hair, and he's firing just at the there's a like a puff of smoke just when the final headshot is fired. Next to him, there is somebody that looks like a railroad worker, and with a helmet on and a white stripy shirt or t-shirt. And behind that, there's somebody that looks like he's in army uniform filming. Now, this man, there's a witness called Gordon Arnold that nobody ever believed, because he said that he was standing there filming the whole thing when the shots were fired. And he said that the shots were fired right over his shoulder, and he just jumped down. He said there were two shots fired, and he just jumped to the ground. And once, when he looked up, there was a police officer standing, pointing at him with some kind of a shotgun or a rifle or something like that, just saying, "Did you film it? Did you film it?" And he was just, he nodded, and the police officer just took the film, ripped it out of the camera, and ran off behind up to the parking lot. Now, there's another witness by the name of Ed Hoffman. He was what do you call it, a mute, deaf mute. He was up on the triple underpass, but a bit further next to the big parking lot. And what he said, he had a clear view down over the parking lot. And what he said was he saw somebody behind the picket fence standing there. And then when the motorcade came, he saw like a puff of smoke. First, he thought that somebody was smoking or something like that. But then he saw the guy turn around with a rifle and then walk towards a man in a railroad worker, throw the gun, the weapon to him, then turn around, put on a hat, and slowly walk back in the other direction. The railroad worker then took the rifle and went a few meters towards the railroad tracks. Then he bent down behind a like an electric what do you call it, installation, I don't know what you call that little building of concrete type of thing.
Okay.
He bent down behind that and he took the rifle apart, like in very quickly, chuk chuk, and put it down in a toolbox, closed the toolbox, and then he slowly started walking towards the trains that were parked on the other side. The same trains that Chauncey Holt was told to run towards if something went down. Anyway, so this witness has been disregarded for many years. I think that what he observed was actually this Lucien Sarti, that after he had got the film from Gordon Arland, who was still in a state of shock, he went behind the picket fence, threw tossed the rifle to the guy that was standing behind next to him, which you can see in this photo, the railroad worker. This railroad worker is also the one that can be observed in the Zapruder film, because in the Zapruder film, when it follows the limousine, you can see that there's a lot of bushes and branches, and then there's a definite, like a helmet, that is very visible in a few frames. That is the backside of this railroad worker, I would say. And Gordon Arnold also saw a railroad worker that morning. So I think that was what happened. So at the same time, to the left of him, if we go back towards the school book depository, are another shooter. I mean, this president, he was just surrounded this day. I tell you, they wanted him dead big time. But when you check out the Orville Nix film and so on, everybody is so focused on trying to see where Batchman is positioned. But if you look a little to the right, there you will see that there's a white car that has been reversed up against the wall. And next to the car, there's a shooter very openly standing with just next to the car, following, aiming at the motor cage. I don't think he ever shot, he fired, but it's very obvious once you see this guy. And this guy, I believe, is this Clyde Forshaw, at least according to Haley Otis, because he told her the story. And also, Abraham Zapruder, who was standing just a few meters from him, said that the shots were fired right from behind him and to the right. So maybe possibly he fired one shot as well. Anyway, so we only got more or less one secure shooter left. I mean, there's different theories about people being in the manholes, shooting from underground. I don't take that for. I'd say that's very possible, but I've never been able to identify who that would be. It could be Roscoe White, a Dallas police officer who claimed that he was part of it. and who later died in a mysterious accident. He was blown up more or less. And also other people have pointed to Frank Sturgis, but according to James Files, Frank Sturgis, who was part of Operation 40, later Watergate burglar and so on, he was on the grassy knoll in a bomber jacket, a green bomber jacket, but just minutes before he left and walked away. So he was there somewhere around the area, but not one of the shooters as far as I can see. I believe that also when you see this white car, the photos that are taken just seconds after the limo has disappeared, when the cameras goes back towards this white wall, the car is already taken off. And you can see one guy in light clothes that is trying to sort of, he's turning around towards the car to jump into it and get out of there. I believe that that car was actually not what Lee Bowers said. He thought it was an Oldsmobile 1961. I think it was a, oh God, my head is just going around in circles. That's so
well,
much.
There's quite a bit, you know, quite a bit. I'm amazed that it's not the, you know, that it's just about the first time you get this. So, but anyway,
Anyway, so the driver of that car, I believe, was Roland Otis, the sister of Haley Otis.
Right.
And Haley Otis had been trying to expose these three killers for many years. He's been going to the authorities in Canada. She's been going to the FBI. She's been trying in so many different ways. And also Professor Jim Fetzer has helped her. And they have just turned her down all the time, instead trying to help get her taken care of. So she's been very close to get killed on many, many occasions. Very extremely brave woman. And she's been handing over lists of, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of victims that has been killed by these people. And
right.
And as far as I know, they're still active to this day. Clive Forshaw is living in Toronto, working as a bus driver, also driving a streetcar, which he's using as a cover. And he's being used by both the mob and the CIA and so on to take out people.
Do you know how old he could be today?
He's getting up in his 70s, I would say.
Man.
Anyway, I think he's born 43 or something like that.
Right. Wow.
There are photos of him in the Carousel Club. Do you know Jack Ruby's Carousel Club?
Mm-hmm.
There are photos of him there. And also, in recent years, he's been going under the name of the Giza Bandit and another one, I cannot remember what the name was, but working as a bank robber together with some people in his family. Anyway, I would just say that if this is true, what Haley Otis said before she disappeared or died, we're talking about some of the worst serial killers ever in modern history. I mean, incredible. The scandal is incredible that the authorities in Canada or the States have not helped her to uncover this or stop it, because it's been going on and on and on and on for all of these years.
Yeah.
And so many innocent people have been killed, children, women, slaughtered for absolutely unnecessary. And Haley Otis said that she thinks one of the reasons why she was still alive was that it was the souls of all of these dead people that they were trying to support her in uncovering this, so that all these poor people, all the families of the victims, could finally get closure, because there's so many unsolved murders that are connected to them.
Well, and it's also worth noting again, I think, mentioning that basically the assassinators themselves might have been in a position where they have been suffering because of the fact that they've been taken at a young age, they've been groomed in this position. I mean, to a certain extent, that is what mind control is right there, you know, and being brought up in this kind of environment, you know, just getting accustomed to that extent. And it also means that the people who are truly, you know, responsible behind the tutoring of these people and management of them and everything, it means, of course, that the guy that pulls the trigger might not necessarily in all cases be the responsible party, but it means that someone behind there have probably pretty afraid of getting their hands dirty, and they're using this, you know, layer and layer after layer of people and you know, organizations in front of them and everything else. So it speaks to a little bit more about the tactics of not letting, you know, letting others do the dirty work, so to speak. But in regards to, I mean, not that the network that you've been speaking about in itself is absolutely fascinating and interesting and the most important thing, you know, in terms of solving the you know, the JFK assassination and everything else. But is there, do you suspect that there's even an inner layer here of people that we do not know about that pull the strings behind this kind of front facade of assassinators and public figures to a certain extent?
Big time, big time. It's just that we're running out of time, so I'm focusing on the street level at the moment.
Sure, no worries
because,
about that. Yeah.
Because just like you say, I'm not here to point any accusing fingers. I'm here to try and reveal and stop this madness that is going on. And it's by exposing the different parts of the jigsaw puzzle, that's the only way to do it. And just like you say, these people that we've been talking about today, they're mechanics, they only know their part of it. They're skilled killers, but some of them with high ethic morals and so on. And the real terrorists, I would say, are the people in suits, sitting, you know, safely behind cover.
Behind their desks, just wielding
desks.
A pen, you know, as opposed to a gun or a sword. Yeah, as usual.
Extremely cowards. Not being able to do these things themselves, and always ducking, diving, and putting down innocent people as patsies. I mean, awful. These are the real terrorists. But at the moment, I'm pointing on the street level, the hit guys.
Yeah.
That I mean, these people, they see, many of them see themselves as freedom fighters, and we, on the other side of the fence, see them as terrorists. You know, it's like Néstor Izquierdo, the spotter in the Daltex building. There are statues of him in Miami, you know.
Right.
And Orlando Bosch, Dr. Death, they have a national holiday in his name, you know. And so it's like people who tried to kill Hitler, were they heroes? Yes, they are heroes, because we see Hitler as a monster. If Hitler had won the war, they would be terrorists, you know. So it's a tricky thing with history, because they thought that they liberated the states from JFK, just like some of the people that were part of killing Olof Palme. They saw it as that they were heroes in liberating the country.
Right.
And we see them as ruthless killers. So what is true?
Well, you know, that's always going to be the case. There's going to be opposing forces in history, and I mean, I want people to think about this as well. This is nothing new. I mean, if you, I've been diving deep into history here in the last couple of months and trying to track. It's kind of a side topic here, of course, but just to tie it into what we've been talking about, you know, trying to pinpoint some of the earlier, you know, peoples around Europe and the different, you know, migration periods that occur with you know, raids and with just movements of people and invasions and everything else. And you come to realize after a while, when you dig into it, it's like, wow, that's like, that is our history right there. You know, it is a history which is bloody, which is about conflict, which is about, you know, territory and resources and pride. And in some cases it's about survival and everything else. And it's just, it's part of our makeup and structure, whether we, you know, like that or not. It's been part of us for such a long time. But so when you go zoom forward, you might think, okay, well, we're past that now. It's all better, you know. It's all, we're not as violent, etc., anymore. But it's still there, and groups like this is a clear evidence that this is just another, you know, guard in this process that have bloomed up to take control, to take power, to you know, benefit from it in different ways. And in some cases, in their view, it's probably been about, you know, survival or squeezing the wrong people who are a threat to their power game out of the picture. So it's there, and we're still living with it. And I think to a certain extent as well, there has to be, just as you've been doing today, just talking about it, exposing it and learning it. But it is up to people who can see this as well and realize this to step up to the plate, you know, as you've done, and become responsible for it, start talking about it so more and more people can know about it. And I mean, if there's a true interest here, there has to be parties that are involved in stopping this kind of behavior. You know what I mean? Otherwise, it will just continue. It will go unchallenged. And so you realize, just as you look back into history, yeah, there were people who were, they were pushed back so far that eventually they struck back. They realized that, you know, if we don't do something here, we're going to be, you know, exterminated. We're going to be taken out. So it's, I just see it as a long continuation. And this is not an isolated case that stands on its own. These are old, you know, crime families that came from, you know, Sicily and, you know, Eastern Europe. And it's from Latin America and Europe and all over the place. And it's just a, I don't know, it's just, I see it as a long line of continuing human behavior, basically.
Yeah. I can only say that this exposure of Walter Tobinski and Clade Forshaw and so on, this is it's highly dangerous to expose this. Dr. Jim Fetzer has already done it in an article in Veterans Today called Serial Killers, the CIA Creates Them, the FBI Neglects Them.
Right.
And I just want to say that... for my own safety as well, I'm not depressed in any way. I'm not, you know, my car runs fine. I have absolutely no intention of killing myself or anything like that. And that the all these hours of, hundreds of hours of interviews with Haley Otis, they're spread all over the world in many different safe places and so on. So it's not possible to stop it. And I just want to say also, if we continue this this whole thing, is that Walter Tobinski has been identified as the person who was as an imposter going to the Mexican, in Mexico City, to the Cuban embassy and the Russian embassy, applying for a visa in the name of Lee Harvey Oswald. They were taking photos when he came out. If you haven't seen them in history books, you can see it in the JFK movie. They show photos of this guy. There was the CIA that took photos of him when he came out. He doesn't look anything like Lee Harvey Oswald at all. Mm-hmm. But this is the guy who's been identified as Walter Tobinski and the guy who's standing there. He is also, according to Haley Otis, he was the actual shooter of Martin Luther King, where the guy next to him in the bushes were a Memphis police officer by the name of Earl Clark. He was the guy who took over the gun and then went into Jim's Grill and threw it over to the owner of James Grill that then took care of it. But the actual shooter was Walter Tobinski. And Clyde Forshaw, according to Haley Otis, I'm only referring to what she says, was the actual shooter of Robert Kennedy. It was not Thane Caesar, the security guard, but that Clyde Forshaw was standing right next to him. Mm-hmm. He's very short. He's only 5'3", and he was dressed like in black and white, like one of these restaurant people. And this is the thing. Also, when it comes to the shooting of J.D. Tippit, you know, there was a killing of a police officer less than an hour after the assassination of JFK that was blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald. When you look at the descriptions from what the witnesses say, especially there was one woman that was totally neglected. The Warren Commission never heard her anything like that, Aquila Clemens. She said that there were two shooters, one tall, slender, and the other guy was short, kind of not chubby, but not very tall, and also with a ruddy complexion. That was one of the other witnesses saw as well.
Right.
The witnesses around the J.D. Tippit killing, they give very, very different descriptions of the assailant, of the assassin. And that, I truly believe, is because there were two different people involved. There was also two different types of ammo involved. He was shot four times, and they found different shells and different bullets in the body of J.D. Tippit. And the reason, I believe that what happened after the shooting was that Lee Harvey Oswald, he was supposed to meet up with David Attlee Phillips in the cinema, the Texas cinema. That was where who and that was. But before that, they were supposed to have taken him out. That the plan was that he was supposed to be shot before that. How he got from the school book depository, if he was the guy who got into the car with David Morales that took off, that was a light green Nash Rambler that I believe was owned by a woman called Ruth Payne, who where she was a very close friend of Marina Oswald, and Marina Oswald was living with her together with her and Lee's two children at the time of the assassination. And this Ruth Payne and her husband were both had both connections to the CIA, so I think they she infiltrated the Oswald family to get control of them from that direction, and that was their car that her car that was used there. But what happened was that Lee Harvey came back to his he was renting a room at North Beckley 1026 North Beckley Street, and his landlady said that he went into his room and apparently changed clothes, got his revolver, a 38 snub nose, and then while he was in his room, there was a police car, a Dallas police car, that stopped just outside the house with two police officers and honking twice, like bop, bop, like a signal. But Lee Harvey Oswald didn't come out, and then the police car took off. Then Lee Harvey came out, and the last time his landlady saw him, he was standing on the other street, side of the street at a bus stop. How he got from there to the cinema, nobody really knows. And the official story that he walked towards the place, and then that J.D. Tippit saw him walking, and that when J.D. Tippit tried to stop him, he pulled his gun and shot him dead. It doesn't make sense at all, because the timing, there's no way he could get there that early. But when you look at the descriptions of the assassins of J.D. Tippit, one of them fits perfectly Clyde Forshaw, and he has also, according to Haley Otis, been bragging about that he was the one that actually killed him. And the other one was a man, I believe, by the name of Gary Marlowe. He was a friend of James Files, the shooter behind the picket fence. But both of them, none of them knew that the other one was working in, at least James Files had no idea that this friend of his, Gary Marlowe, was there at the time. And the only way that Gary Marlowe could have known, because he came to the Lamplighter Motel after the assassination, when James Files was there washing off everything. He even waxed his whole body to get rid of any kind of stains of powder and so on. And once he was, while he was hiding there, suddenly somebody was knocking at the door. And the only two people who knew that James Files was at that motel, or three people, was Lee Harvey Oswald, David Attlee Phillips, and Chucky Nicoletti. So it's most probable that this Gary Marlowe that came and knocked on the door, that he was also under being controlled by David Attlee Phillips of the CIA.
Yeah.
Anyway, he came and knocked on James Files' door and said, "My God, I just had to kill a cop. Here, the gun is here. Please take it, take it. I need to get rid of it." And James Files said, "No way. You just, you know, get lost. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not touching that." So Gary Marlowe just took off and disappeared. And James Files has absolutely no idea what happened afterwards. But in these type of operations, they always have like almost like a crew of backup people that can be activated at all times. You know, whatever happens, they will have, if they need alternative shooters, if they need cleanup teams, whatever, they can be, with a single call, they can be activated very quickly. And I believe that is what happened when Lee Harvey Oswald slipped out of their grip, because I think he was supposed to be killed in the Texas School Book Depository so that it could be case closed right away. But instead, he managed to get out. And after that, they were looking for him everywhere. And when you start seeing, when you look down into the behavior of J.D. Tippit before he was killed, for about half an hour, 45 minutes, people saw him cruise around. He looked very agitated. He was standing in his patrol car, just watching cars, and one car he speeded after and just pulled in front and jumped out and ran in and checked the back seat and everything, if somebody was hiding in it. And the people in the car saw the name J.D. Tippit on the badge and so on. So he also stopped his car right outside a record shop and went in and made a phone call. He was very nervous and agitated, but nobody answered. So he threw down the receiver and jumped out into the car and took off. And a few minutes later, this thing happened. What I think happened was that the car that was in Dealey Plaza, the one that was reversed up on against the wall, that where Clyde Forshaw and Roland Otis, I think also Gary Marlowe was in this car after the assassination, and they were driving around, cruising around, trying to find Lee Harvey Oswald so that they could shut him up before he could get away. And I think that according to Haley Otis, Clyde Forshaw is almost a lookalike of Lee Harvey Oswald. They looked very similar, and he was also the guy pretending to be Lee Harvey Oswald in one of the shooting ranges where he was shooting, and one of the other people's targets, you know, where you can see that in the JFK movie where the other guy gets really pissed off, and then this guy, the impersonator of Oswald, says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I thought it was that goddamn Kennedy," you know, very discreet. You know, once again, painting this Patsy black. Anyway, I think that that J.D. Tippit, by mistake, stopped when he saw these people wandering around, jumps out and say, "What the hell are you doing?" And he starts pulling his gun, and Clyde Forshaw kills him or shoots him with one, and Gary Marlowe as well. Both of them open fire against the guy. Finishes up with a headshot, and then they run in two directions. Clyde Forshaw makes a signal to Gary Marlowe, just go, 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 and they take off in different directions. This is what I believe happened. If you can manage just a few minutes more.
Oh, yeah, sure, of course.
I would like to go back to Dealey Plaza because we still have James Files left on the grassy knoll.
Mm-hmm.
So behind the wall, behind the badge man, behind the railroad worker, there are a few meters behind them, there's this picket fence where there was a tree standing. And what James Files has told was that he positioned himself there because it was a perfect spot for a direct headshot. And Charles Nicoletti had said to him, you are only here as a backup. Let us do the shooting, or let me do the shooting. We are only going for a headshot, and it's only if something goes wrong that you open fire. Because his position would also reveal that there were more than one shooters. The other shooters were more or less from behind, but from his position, that would be from the wrong direction. Anyway, like I said, James Files, he said he would be honored to do it. And so he positions himself behind the picket fence. And the weapon he's chosen is an XP-100 Remington Fireball. That is like a pistol rifle. It was a very advanced weapon at that time, or it still is when you look at it. It looks like a rifle, but like with a pistol grip and a very short barrel. And it was a single-shot pistol rifle with a caliber 222.222. And It was manufactured by Remington, and it didn't get into the open shops before a year or so after the assassinations. But the CIA were using prototypes and were very fond of this weapon. And David Attlee Phillips had actually given James Files this gun earlier on, and he had used it twice before the JFK assassination. For this, he had prepared for this job. I don't know if he knew, but he had prepared anyway. He had prepared ammunition back in Chicago, and he had used a man called by the name of Wolfman, an expert that was working for the mob, doing all their weapons and so on. And they had prepared ammo where they had drilled the top of these .222. I mean, the caliber is very, it's not a big caliber, but on a short distance, extremely powerful. And they drilled up the top of the bullets and filled them with mercury, making them absolutely totally explode on impact and not leaving any traces of ballistic material that could be traced or anything like that. So he was standing and he had a little like a briefcase type of thing where this gun fitted in. So he was standing behind the picket fence waiting for the motorcade to come, and the whole time he was just checking the crowd if there was any people, like they say, packing, you know, with guns, or any kind of people that he had to watch out for, because he was, according to what he says, he was not aware of that there was a lot of that this whole big operation was going on. He just knew his little part, and that was to be a backup shooter for Chucky Nicoletti. So when the motorcade started coming around the corner, he was observing it through the scope. He had a time three time scope, so he put that on, and he had the gun down by his side. Then when the motorcade came around, he just put the gun up on top of the picket fence and was just totally focusing in on the president heads, because he had been given direct orders not to hit anyone, especially not Jacqueline. That was the whole thing. So when the shots started coming, he didn't count the shots as like 1, 2, 3, 4. He counted them as miss, 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 and so on, because he knew that they were going for a headshot, and he saw that he, even though Kennedy was being hit, he could see that because his body was jerking, but he knew that he hadn't been hit in the head. So he waited until the very last second and then boom, pulled the trigger. And he said that he hit Kennedy straight over the right eye near the template, and it just blew the whole back of his head out. But he was actually aiming for the right eye, and just before he pulled the trigger, he saw that the head just moved forward. And when you look at what actually happened, it looks really a lot like Kennedy was hit in the head just like a thousandth of a second before the headshot from the right came. So after that, what happened was that he bent down and he turned his jacket inside out. He was observed by Lee Bowers as well, by the way, by with a man, a young man with a like a, I don't know what you call it, checkered shirt, that type of thing. But what he had was actually a like a bomber jacket, but silvery color on the outside, and with this checkered inside
Pattern on the inside, yeah.
pattern.
Like
So he had
a
turned.
lining or something, yeah, like that.
Exactly. But this was one of these jackets you could turn inside out and use both ways. So what he did was he had turned it the wrong way inside out while he was waiting. And then what he did was he went down, put the gun into the case, turned his jacket inside out, and put his like a cap hat on his head, then stood up. But before that, what he also did was, because very stupidly done, but very cocky as well. You know, he was 21. He had killed a lot of people. He thought he was invincible, and he was just pumped with adrenaline. One of the things that he used to do when he had killed somebody was take the shell while it was still smoking, and taste the sulfur and just bite down on it. And what he did was he did exactly that, and he put the shell on top of the picket fence. It's like he said afterwards, if Chucky Nicoletti had known that, he would turn around in his grave, you know, because it was just so stupid. But he said, that was what I did. And also he said that while he was waiting, he was smoking Pall Mall, and it was really muddy behind the fence, and he was just standing, trotting around there. Anyway, after that, he stood up and he walked straight from the picket fence. And there's one picture where you can see a silhouette that fits exactly what he's saying. And then he walked behind the school book depository, across Houston Street, and into the Chevy Impala that was parked there. And inside were Chucky Nicoletti in the front seat and Roselli in the back. So nobody said anything, and they took off, except Chucky Nicoletti said, "My God, you were a bit what did he say? Something like you bit of overdid that, didn't you? Which was a bit, well, Files was quite insulted by that.
Right.
But anyway, so he drove a few blocks off, took to the left under the highway, and there was a gas station there where he dropped them off. They went in and took another car. He had no idea what happened to them, how they split up or whatever. And after that, like I said, he went to the Lamplighter Hotel, stayed overnight, and then took off in the morning and way back to Chicago. And he thought that nobody knew about this until I think it was the early 1990s or something like that, when it turned out that the FBI had known about him since 1964 and so on. This he has absolutely not come forward voluntarily with this information. It's been a long road where he has absolutely nothing to gain from it, and he's even turned down people like Oliver Stone and people offering him masses of money and so on for his story.
Right.
He's turned everybody down. It's just because a loyalty thing to a friend of his that made him come forward with or admit to these things.
Right. Well, as bad as that is, you could give him that then, if nothing else, that they are in that regards not sell out for easy money, but they do have allegiance to their own little network there. So I guess
No,
that.
big time. Big time. It really is. He's a man of, I would say, a man of honor, big time. A very violent, with a very, very violent background, but it's like death before dishonor. He has never ratted on anyone. He's been tortured. He's been left as dead. He's been, I don't know, killed. They tried to kill him so many times, but he's never ratted on anyone, you know. And now he's a reborn Christian in jail, I think in Illinois or somewhere. So, but I think he's not a man to disregard. I would very much recommend people to really listen to what he's saying. And there's a there's a very interesting book by a Dutch man called Wim Dankbar, and it's
Say
called
that
Fa
again, Ulla. Say that again. What was the name?
Wim Dankbar, and the title of the book is Files on JFK. And also, there are some filmed interviews with James Files where you can find on YouTube and so on. So, I'm getting a sore throat here.
Yeah, I hear that it's a little bit throaty and difficult after speaking Swedish and or Danish, or maybe you're speaking Spanish more now, but nonetheless it's a switch over to speak English for a long time, so you've done very well, and I haven't interjected much, so good job, Ulla, of course. And I mean, what a fascinating story listening to this, and you piecing together all of this. It's clear that it's a passion of yours as well to track this network and see the interlocking assassinations with all the other assassinations that has occurred. So I mean, good job. Is there anything you'd like to add to this here before we wrap things up? I do want to give out some details of yours again so people know how to find you, and you're continuing your work as well, of course, but either if you want to talk about something you have upcoming or just something to add, the floor is yours.
I would first like to honor the memory of Haley Otis, if she's not among us anymore. I don't know, but she has gone very quiet, and it seems like she's not with us anymore. I would also say that
Sorry to interrupt that. Do you know when the last time someone heard from her was?
it's about 6 weeks ago, something like that.
All right. Okay. So it might
And
not be. She might have just taken some privacy here, but we're not sure. We have to keep watching that.
I don't know, but I also just want to say once again that if anything should happen to me or anyone close to me or someone, it will only confirm what I have said. You know, this will not be covered over or shut down or in any way, and that the material that I'm talking about as well is in multiple places that cannot be traced and on encrypted servers all over the place and so on. So I would strongly suggest that the government of Canada and the States would look into this and start cleaning up their act big time. And also, I would say that once again, the reason why this historical event is so important is because it's still going on. It's the same power elite, even the same people sometimes, are still active to this very day. People from Operation 40 are still on duty.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And one of the members, well, his name is Porto Goss. He was elected the chief of the CIA not many years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so they're still around, and they're very efficient. The Operation 40.
Conspiracies don't exist. I've read about that stuff.
I know. But
you know, it's amazing when it's so. Sorry, Ulla, but it's amazing when it's so, you know, so in your face and such a clear network that exists out there, and yet people continue to deny, you know, and all the people in charge in government and these authorities and official positions and the interlocking network into the corporate world. It's all fine. It's all good. They have our best interest at heart, right?
Well, I do not think so. And but I tell you, if it was not for people like myself that put ourselves or yourself, who takes a stand and who stands up and dare to speak about these things, it would just continue, because the only reason why this is being exposed are from civil, normal people, truth seekers, who are just saying, we will not accept this anymore. It's time to stop the madness. It is not okay to let this continue, because while we're picking our nose and changing channel, lots of innocent people are getting hurt in all of these wars and terror acts and so on that are being carried out by the same group. So it's time to stop it big time. I really think so. And I very often in these interviews, I speak directly to people in uniform and police officers and so on too, so that they please inform themselves about whose agenda they're carrying
out. Exactly. Because who are you working for? Yeah.
Who are you working for? Because your job is to protect us, the citizens of your country. It is not your job to protect villains and murderers and mass murderers. I mean, we're talking about, it's on a scale that is absolutely mind-blowing once you get into this. And all of these wars that are being carried out by the same group and so on, that are just, it needs to stop. It really needs to stop.
Well, the slogan of the, I think, the majority of the U.S. police out there is to protect and serve. But I mean, that means they don't say who after that sentence. So, you know, who knows what the real contract is there, right?
Yeah.
That's why they call it a criminal justice system, because it's there to serve and protect the criminals, you know.
It's a good description of it.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been very interesting. By the way, are you planning on composing something more on this, on the connections and networks here, Ulla? So something that's come to you, you know, further on later in the research process, or you're just going to continue to speak about it primarily? Any plans on that? Anything?
I really would like to make a documentary. I'm trying to get in touch with highly skilled documentary makers, especially John Pilger from Australia, or Nigel Turner from the UK, or other people, not happy amateurs, but really, really skilled people. Because when you come forward with truths of this dignity, you need to make it high quality to make it believable. And what I'm aiming at is to make a documentary showing the history of Operation 40, connecting all of these major assassinations and terror acts, from everything from 9/11, Oklahoma City, all the way up until today, JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, all of them are connected big time.
Yeah.
And I think a documentary that could clearly prove and show the links between that could have a big impact. So that is a major focus on me to get that done.
All right, very, very good. Now, let's give out the websites here again for people, and if there's anything else you know, there that you'd like to add to it. But again, thanks for a good time and just a very interesting another interesting program. Well, we'll speak more again, of course. There's much more to the story and as your work continues as well. But give us the website and we'll end on that note then.
My website is www.lightonconspiracies.com. Lightonconspiracies.com. And my book, I've written several, but the book about this is called Coup d'État in Slow Motion. It's about mainly about the assassination of Olof Palme, but it shows the links going into all of these different directions, and also the connections to the JFK assassination, the sinking of Estonia, and so on. And like I mentioned before, I am extremely grateful for any type of donations or subscriptions on my newsletter and so on, because it is very, very hard to do this type of research without funding, and I'm a single person who are just trying to get by in normal daily life, feeding my family, but who feels very strongly that this is one of the reasons I'm alive, that I should be part of exposing this. And I would very much like, if it's okay with you, to just end this with a prayer. Not
Sure,
that
certainly.
I'm not a religious person, but I feel that I'm very spiritual. And I've got this yoga teacher of mine, a beautiful lady that always ends with the same prayer, and it goes like this. May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who hurt us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light. I think that is the way to go, because these forces, you cannot fight them with violence. If you hit back, they're 50 million times stronger, and they will only use it as an excuse to put even more surveillance and security forces on your case and so on. So that is not the way to go. The way to go is to lift the whole thing, lift the vibrations with gratitude and compassion and love, to make yourself stronger. Because this is not a situation to go into and behave like a wimp or so on. It's like the native Indian says, we the people, the souls that are here at this time, we're the strongest of the strong. We are the strongest of the strong, and we are here for a reason, and that is to take us through this dark time into this beautiful future that will embrace us on the other side, if we have the courage, the integrity, and the stamina to just carry on, stand side by side, brothers and sisters, join arms, and just say, enough. We've had enough. We are tired of this. We're not going to let it happen anymore. Because the crazy thing is that we're doing it to ourselves. This is the absolute mad thing, that we are doing it to ourselves. This global elite I'm talking about, they're only like a few thousand people, and we're more than 7 billion. So it's an absolute joke that we let this carry on. Absolute joke.
Yeah, and it's also about how they managed to steer those, 7 billion, 6 billion people in terms of, people get enthralled and dragged into things. They're part of battles which they believe is the right thing, just as you detailed before about their, not in that regard intelligence, and they don't think about who they're working for and everything else. But we have to be smarter than that dark side, and it takes many shapes and forms and everything else. And there are multiple battle fronts at this time as well. The historical context of how violence has been used and conquest, as they continue to use it, is of course a very, very, in that regard, is an old technique. I mean, we have to use information. We have to, there's
yeah.
speaking out. There's a number of different ways to fight the battle. And I mean, that's certainly part of it. And it's just about being smart and just taking that long-term plan into context and choosing your battles and fighting the right things as well, because there's a lot of, trappings and trapdoors out there as well. So, keep focused and stay focused on the root of the issue and strike there. But thank you again. I really appreciate having you on, and keep up the good work. And we say thanks to everyone for listening as well. We'll be back with more in just a few days.
Thank you so much, Henrik.
Okay, there you go. A longer extended program for you today. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your membership, of course. We have upcoming David Icke on his latest book, The Perception Deception. Brian Forster with L.A. Marzulli on the Paracas elongated skull DNA results. And then we also have Marty Leeds and later Yuri Geller, to name a few. Don't miss that one. We'll be back in just a few days. In the meantime, stay tuned to redicemembers.com. Check our news, take care, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye-bye.